Order.
Once again, it'll be eyes down for a full house when the year in Parliament's debating chamber begins at 2 p.m. on Tuesday. And just like last year, the Speaker, David Carter, will start by announcing a change in the membership following the departure of the Trade Minister, Tim Grosser, to become the country's ambassador in Washington, D.C. He was a List MP, so unlike last year when National's Mike Sabin's resignation required a by-election in the Northland seat, Mr. Grosser's replacement is the next name on the National Party's list. That's Maureen Pugh, former Westland District Mayor and National's candidate for the West Coast Tasman electorate in the last general election. She didn't win the seat, but only just missed out on becoming a List MP when National dropped a seat after the counting of special votes. She's expected to be in the chamber on Tuesday to be sworn in and take her seat on National's backbench to hear party leaders then deliver eulogies in memory of Labour's former Deputy Prime Minister, Bob Tizard, who died in Auckland late last month at the age of 91. And as usual, at the start of the parliamentary year, the first formal business on the order paper is the Prime Minister's statement. John Key has 20 minutes to deliver his statement, and leaders of the main parties each have 20 minutes, while other speakers have 10. The whole debate is set down to take 13 hours, and that means no general debate this week, although there will be the first question time of the year on Wednesday. And while that will see the debating chamber up and running, the summer holiday is already a distant memory elsewhere in the parliamentary complex. Cabinet has already met, and the committee rooms have been occupied for the past couple of weeks, as Rhys Lyon reports.
While two select committees began their year with annual reviews of government agencies on Tuesday, the first official select committee business of 2016 took place the previous week, with the Finance and Expenditure Committee meeting on Tuesday, January the 26th, for the annual review of Air New Zealand. A week later, the annual review of Maritime New Zealand on Tuesday, February the 2nd, was a chance for its chairman, David Leadsom, to outline to the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee the scope of his organisation's responsibilities.
Each year, on average, more than 800 foreign cargo vessels make around 5,700 port calls, transporting 99% of New Zealand's trade by volume. 6 million passengers use Harbour and Cook Strait ferries to get to work or go on holiday. Over 12 million tonnes of oil and 4 million tonnes of freight is transported around our coast. Over 1,500 commercial vessels operate around our coast, generating $1.5 billion in export earnings. More than 30 cruise ships make 120 voyages and 700 port calls, and 1.3 million people take to the water on 960,000 recreational craft.
David Leadsom pointed to a key aspiration for Maritime New Zealand.
A maritime community that works and plays safely and securely on clean waters. Our progress towards this in the financial year under consideration was satisfactory. The commercial sector safety trends are moving in the right direction, although there is further work to be done to enable improvements in accident and incident reporting in some areas. The recreational boating toll remains stubbornly high, despite sustained investment in promotion and education, particularly on the importance of wearing life jackets.
Later, Maritime New Zealand bosses faced questions from committee members. New Zealand First MP Clayton Mitchell asked about the safety of the Taharoa Destiny vessel, which is anchored off the west coast of the North Island, there to facilitate the dredging of iron sand from the seabed.
My understanding that that vessel is swinging off a 40-year-old buoy that hasn't been kept up to service, and when it has been pretty close a couple of times, In recent time, its stern's actually swung quite closely to running aground. Now, that's the largest vessel that comes into New Zealand waters. What steps is Maritime New Zealand doing to secure that? Because I now understand there's three ships coming and swinging off that, so it's basically constantly being moored. The buoy is actually was designed around 150,000 tonnes, and now we've got ships that are 175,000 tonnes. I see that as New Zealand's next largest shipping disaster, and you know, what are we doing to make it not become New Zealand's largest shipping disaster?
In answer to that, Maritime New Zealand Director Keith Manch sought to allay Mr Mitchell's concerns.
So on the buoy issue in particular, we understand that New Zealand Steel is looking to replace the buoy this year, but in the last year or slightly more, we've been through a process where we've had international experts undertake a full audit of the operation at Tararua, commenting on every issue from the buoy to the nature of the shipping operation and the like. Everything that's been identified in the audit, we're now working through with New Zealand Steel to make sure it's all dealt with appropriately. We don't consider the buoy to be, essentially unsafe or kind of risky as it is at the moment, in a sense that the operation has to stop, but it's important that it gets replaced in due course.
Is there a contingency in place for an incident or an accident to occur for cleanup?
Yes, there are. We've had quite a close look at how we would respond were there an incident in Tararua, of course. So we're satisfied that the operation is undertaken safely, and for a shipping operation that's, as all are, inherently risky, it's going pretty well.
And has the Minister of Transport been updated on all this sort of information, so he's aware of what's going on in Tararua?
We keep him informed. These matters are specific decisions that are statutorily independent for the Director of Maritime New Zealand, my role. So yes, we keep him informed, but all of the decision making is separate from the Minister or indeed the Board in terms of the way the legislation works.
Maritime New Zealand Director Keith Manch speaking to the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee. And across the corridor on Tuesday, the Local Government and Environment Committee held the annual review of the Environmental Protection Authority, or EPA. Its chairwoman, Kerry Prendergast, said that the funding structure for the EPA's role in monitoring New Zealand's Exclusive Economic Zone, or EEZ, had caused some challenges.
One of the most significant of which is the need for EEZ funding to become part of the baseline budget allocation for the EPA. We have faced funding challenges and uncertainty for the EEZ since 2012, when Cabinet agreed that many of the services the EPA provides to deliver its EEZ responsibilities under the Act would be Crown funded. The EPA has never received permanent funding for that proportion of the function, and unfunded EEZ commitments are the biggest part of our budget gap. So for the past 2 years, the EEZ function has been funded as a one-off single-year allocation. $2.7 million was provided in 14-15, and $4 million was allocated in 15-16 to fund EEZ-wide discharge and dumping functions, but they were one-off with no certainty of sustainable funding to our baseline appropriation. 3 years of discussions have not yet changed the situation, and the resulting uncertainty over our funding raises questions over our long-term sustainability of the EEZ function, the EPA, more generally. Although I would note that I understand we do have support for Treasury for an increase in our baseline funding for the next 2 years for this function. But that's still got a long way to go before it gets signed off.
Ms Prendergast's concerns about EEZ funding raised questions from Green Party committee member Eugenie Sage.
Are you saying that even though the EEZ legislation was passed in 2012, that there is no certain baseline funding for the EPA to undertake its responsibilities for 94% of New Zealand's marine environment? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. But we are working very closely now, and we hope that we will get that.
What do you think the block is to getting that certainty that you will get baseline funding?
I understand Treasury signed off an investment-ready proposal so that they're confident that the money we need in our baseline for EEZ funding is the amount we do need, and we do seem to have come to an agreement on that, but it will be subject to Parliament.
Meanwhile, Environmental Protection Authority Chief Executive Dr Alan Freeth outlined another issue facing the EPA.
Many marine research organisations would like to leave their what they call sacrificial anchors sitting on the sea floor, so just cut the cable if they've had sonar buoys or something for whale movement. We've got our first application actually coming to me shortly around that, and we really do want to get that resolved because we don't want to disincentivise marine research, but nor do we want people to leave stuff behind.
And Dr Freeth said that tied in with another of his roles.
You may not be aware of it, I am responsible for burials at sea as well. So if you want to get buried at sea, I'm afraid you've got to come to me. There's five places you can be buried at sea. and for some reason I seem to have that responsibility.
Environmental Protection Authority Chief Executive Dr. Alan Freeth speaking to the Local Government and Environment Committee on Tuesday. In total, there were 5 annual reviews of government agencies held by select committees during the week.
That report from Rhys Lyon. And after hearing about ships and trains on Tuesday, members of the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee had a chance to question the Chairman and Chief Executive of WorkSafe. This is the regulatory agency set up in the wake of the Pike River coal mine disaster, in existence since late 2013. It's responsible for enforcing health and safety regulations following the passing of the Health and Safety at Work Act last year. The third reading debate of that bill, as you may recall, featured a furious argument over whether or not farming was to be classified as a dangerous business. That argument began as a result of amendments made by the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee, and on Tuesday, opposition MPs on it couldn't wait to pick up where they left off last year in the Chamber. Labour's Sue Moroney asked WorkSafe's Chief Executive, Gordon MacDonald, if he had contributed to debate over agriculture's safety classification.
Did WorkSafe make a submission to the consultation on the schedule that the government has put out about which industries are considered high risk and which ones aren't?
No, we don't make
put a submission on?
No.
Have you given the government any advice on that?
No. We provided information on statistics and that's it. It's for the government to decide its policy.
So the government hasn't asked you, WorkSafe, for advice on whether agriculture should be considered a high-risk industry or not.
But it's important to distinguish. It's been determined in the way that you describe for one aspect of one part of the law. The fundamental proposition that all businesses, irrespective of size, irrespective of risk, irrespective of sector, need to have good worker engagement and participation processes.
Mr. MacDonald also faced questions from the Greens' Denise Roche about the agency's approach to hauling offenders into court.
It looks to me as if prosecution is actually a deterrent for bad practice around health and safety. What are the criteria that have changed to assess?
Well, of course,
to assess what should be prosecuted.
Yeah. Well, the tests of prosecution that a private person needs to apply are different from what a public body such as WorkSafe needs to apply. It's not a question of risk aversion, it's a question of being public bodies having to conform quite rightly to a set of principles, because we don't take prosecution lightly and neither should we. So we have to conform to those principles. That's not risk aversion, that's making sure that we are living the ethos and the rule of what the public guidelines say.
WorkSafe's Chief Executive, Gordon MacDonald, navigating some tricky political waters at his agency's annual financial review before the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee on Tuesday. And more political controversy lies ahead as that committee finalises its report on the Employment Standards Legislation Bill, due back in the Chamber by Friday and set to a new debate on zero-hour contracts. I'm Tom Frewen, and this programme was made with funding from Parliament.